This week, on a special episode of WebMD's Health Discovered podcast, we're taking a closer look at a common form of lung cancer that accounts for 85% of all cases.
When I first heard the words, "you have lung cancer," I was in shock.
It's a diagnosis that changes everything. So what does it really mean to advocate for yourself when you're living with non-small cell lung cancer? Listen to Health Discovered on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Introducing Home Care Plus, a new subscription service from Lowe's that helps make life easier by giving members a hand with home maintenance. Let Lowe's tackle the tasks you keep meaning to do, like electric dryer vent cleaning, replacing hard-to-reach light bulbs, and more. Subscribe to Home Care Plus for just $99 a year and consider your to-do list done. Members get more at Lowe's. Available in select zip codes only. Cancel anytime. Non-refundable fee. Product purchase required. Terms and service restrictions apply. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Subject to change.
Today on The Grave Talks, the haunted Eloise Asylum.
Will I find you in my wandering? If you want me.
Originally constructed in 1839, the haunted Eloise Asylum was designed to be a place of refuge for the souls that society didn't want to see. The mentally ill, rejected, poor, sick, and those that didn't fit the mold of being normal would call the Eloise Asylum home. Over the course of more than 100 years, the campus would grow to 75 buildings and house more than 8,000 patients at its peak. Eventually, the United States government would choose to massively defund care for the mentally ill and would result in the closing of the Eloise Asylum. It is at this time that the spirits of those who call the Eloise home would find the silence a perfect platform to be heard again by the living. Today, we discuss the haunted Eloise Asylum with Todd Vonner of Detroit Paranormal.
Eloise started around 1839 as a poor farm or poorhouse or infirmary, too, they called it. Mm-hmm. Back in those days, I guess you could compare it to, I guess, maybe a homeless shelter, or there was no federal programs, social services, or welfare at that time. So, you know, different communities would set up, or counties at this point would set up poor houses, poor farms, mm-hmm. for people that didn't have anywhere to go. Sometimes it'd be wives that their husbands were killed. Children even would go there. And they would work to kind of earn their keep to stay on the farm. And it kept growing and growing. And it was an infirmary at one time, too. And then it expanded because they needed health care. So that's when the first hospital was built on Eloise property, and it was on 902 acres. It was a huge, huge piece of property. But it went from the Wayne County Poorhouse to, it just kept growing. I don't understand why exactly it grew so large, but it grew to 78 buildings, I believe, on 902 acres. And it had its own, basically, it was its own self-contained city. Mm-hmm. They had a bakery, a police department, fire department, greenhouse, actually. They had a farm. They had chickens and pigs, and they grew tobacco. They had a general hospital, and they had a store for the patients. It was really remarkable. I mean, you can't really put that in words, or there's nothing to compare it to in this day and age.
Yeah, it's hard to picture what that would be today because it doesn't really exist today's culture. What was life like, though, when you look back at it towards the beginning before they did all the expansion and it became more of a hospital environment, when it was what they called at the time a poor farm, essentially a homeless shelter of the day, if you will, where people can go, but there was more to it. It wasn't just here's a place to sleep at night. It was an ecosystem as well. There was a purpose to going there. To get your shelter, you would work. What was life like in such a setting? How can someone understand, what the comforts or lack thereof were in this setting? Because I've heard so many stories of different, what was called, again, poor farms of the time. Some were actually quite pleasant. Some were hellish. Tell me the story of what this was like.
I mean, I think Eloise began, I mean, even when it grew to the psychiatric hospital it grew into, I think they always try to make people feel comfortable. They wanted to keep it as a family environment. because these people had no one. The people they met here, you know, the person you slept next to was your neighbor, basically, was your family. And it was a lot of work. It was the kids had to work. Farming obviously was a lot different back in those days than what it is today. There was a lot of manual labor back in those days. But they did their own sewing, their clothing they made, shoes they even made for themselves. And it was kind of the it was also part of a stagecoach stop between Chicago, Detroit, to get to, you know, Canada and the Great Lakes and the shipping and all that stuff. So people would try and find work. I don't think back in those days people wanted to rely on someone giving them something without giving back. It's set up a lot different now. That's what it's like. I try to tell my kids about it because you can't even picture it. When I describe it, it's they're like, what? Because it's not the way it's set up anymore. But I believe it was a hard life, obviously, for those people. And it was a humbling experience for a lot of those people. Because, you know, some of the wives that have to come there with their kids, their husbands died in the war.
Yeah.
Or they had no family here at all. It's sad in a way, but it was a hard life. But I think in the beginning, they were happy. And they had to make the best of it. You know, that was it for them. We're talking about, you know, before we came on air, talking about Michigan, the winters, they're pretty harsh here.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And there was no big snow plows or salting like there is now. It was a hard life. It wasn't the easiest life to live.
Yeah, and what's interesting about the poor farm concept of that point in time is it wasn't just because you were poor that you went there. Obviously, that was the result of where you were coming from, but how you got to that place was something entirely different for almost everyone going in there. You had a huge mix of individuals that either were down on their luck, were, like you said, a widow or something from the war at the time, too, as well. A man could simply just divorce the wife for pretty much any reason he wanted and say, you're gone, and then she's out to the poor farm. That's where you sometimes maybe heard a grandparent or somebody saying, he's going to send you to the poorhouse, or he's going to send me to the poorhouse, or something like that, because it really was that easy of a decision that the male could make in the relationship, which is pretty crazy to look at, but that's how it worked. So you had this insane mix of people, and I don't mean everyone was insane. It was a crazy mix of people. Yes. who had no mental disabilities, people who were living a very normal life last week, to everything. I mean, to schizophrenic, to any sort of, you know, mental disability, physical disability, to anything. It was just this huge mix of people that were in there. And then many times expected to almost everyone pull their weight in a somewhat equal fashion, which obviously we know today does not necessarily work so well when that is the tactic that's employed. I just really like to try and paint that picture for someone who's unaware of what this is, again, because this type of concept does not exist anymore and has not for many generations. So this place is in existence. It's harsh winters. It's Michigan. It's its own community. Let's get a little bit further into its life as what would be known as an asylum, and its sprawling campus, essentially, of building after building. How did these buildings continue to pop up? What was the ecosystem like as the future progressed into the 1900s, the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and beyond?
Well, I think, you know, as the poorhouse started to get bigger and a larger population, like I was saying, the need for healthcare grew. So that's when they built the first hospital there. And then you had around 1911, the tuberculosis outbreak happened across the United States. And that's when they first built the TB sanitarium. There's also a tuberculosis sanitarium there also. And I've looked at pictures. That was a sad, a lot of photos, old historic photos from the sanitarium there. And that was a sad setup. There wasn't much to do for the people. Basically, they came there to die. And the treatment there was fresh air. So there was bed after bed lined up in the old sanitarium, rows of beds. And the few photos I saw were the men's ward. And there were just guys laying in their bed or sitting in the bed. And they had, at the end of their bed, there was a long hall, but it was screened off. It was just open air. And that was a treatment for tuberculosis back then. There was really no medical treatment until they got under control, obviously. And it's very rare to see that in the United States. I mean, it pops up every now and then. But back then, you know, 1911 or so, 1910 is when the huge outbreak, it killed a lot of people back in those days. And just the pictures and the photos of those men, I could actually send you a few. I might have some. It's just sad. They look sad. You feel bad for them.
And there was no treatment, so eventually the end result is death after being in the tuberculosis hospital for a very high percentage, correct?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there was no. I mean, a lot of people would somehow get cured, I guess, on their own, but the death rate was very, very high back in those days.
Yeah. I mean, so to get out of that, it was extremely rare. How did they handle such a thing? Let me ask you that. When you have a hospital filled with people with a contagious disease that is essentially a death sentence, how did they care for individuals when with any sort of nursing staff? I would imagine there was great risks to any sort of nursing staff going into a building that is essentially filled with people with tuberculosis.
Right. And it was pretty much quarantined off. It was set at the back of the property. The nursing staff, you know, they had to pay them extra to actually go in there. But, you know, Eloise, it was like the state-of-the-art, believe it or not, hospital back in those days, which I still look, some of the treatments and procedures they did are barbaric, you know, but back then those were what they did. That was the top of the line treatment. And so to me, it feels, and from what I read, it just, they were just left to die basically with in peace. They were taking care of the best they possibly could. There wasn't, like I said, there wasn't much anyone can do for them.
What were some of the treatments that you had referenced there that we look on now as barbaric? What were some of the things that they did to try and help the people in what they viewed was the right way to do it at the medical science of the time?
Well, Eloise, as far as the psychiatric care, there's a hospital, it started in New York with lobotomies, and Eloise was the first hospital outside of New York to actually do lobotomies. That was, you know, one of the big treatments back in those days. Also, they did electroshock therapy, which is still used today, but not the way they did it back then. And the theory behind a lot of these were that, especially electroshock therapy, they would jolt these people. And if you had schizophrenia or anxiety, depression, it would knock you. It kind of, they thought it would kind of click you back. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like reset your brain. And sometimes it would work for, it was just a temporary fix. They also did insulin therapy there, where they would inject patients with high doses of insulin, even though they weren't diabetic, and they would go into convulsions and seizures. And then they would come out of it, they would have a little moment of lucidity. And they thought that was helping them when obviously it wasn't. It was tearing their livers up and internal organs. Electroshock therapy, lobotomies, insulin therapy. They did hydrotherapy where they would put a patient, and this, from what I understood from nurses that actually came through Eloise that I've met and talked to that worked there back in the 50s and 60s, they would either put these patients in really cold water or really hot water. And usually it was for people with anxiety and depression, and it worked to snap them kind of out for a temporary fix. It was nothing was permanent. Mm-hmm. They also pioneered music therapy. So they would have patients play music and listen to music, and they had television therapy when television finally came out, you know, late 50s, early 50s. So they tried everything there, and a lot of them obviously were kind of barbaric. Music therapy is still used today, and electroshock therapy is used in low doses today, but those other ones are haven't been used in decades. But that's what those doctors were taught, you know, going through medical school. Mm-hmm. And it was a treatment of the times, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's really of no fault to their own. And I think that's something that should be stressed when we talk about these things, because it's like, oh, these were monsters. No, this is what they were taught. This is what people thought was the correct way of doing things. And I can only imagine there will be things that we are able to look back upon 50 years from now, if we're still around, 60, 70 years from now further, that we go, oh my God, they did that? Maybe some things that aren't quite as barbaric as we look at, but still things that we may look at and go, well, that was, why on earth would they think that would work?
know? Right.
And I think, especially with like some prescription drugs and things of that nature, and I'm in no way anti-prescription drug, but the way that obviously some of those have been abused or overprescribed and things of that nature, I think we'll look back on some of those as, holy shit, you did what?
Right.
So this is very interesting where all of these things would take place on this campus. Obviously, many, many people spending great amounts of time there, great amounts of their life there, and many people, their lives ending there, whether it be from a disease or a treatment gone wrong.
Right.
How did the Eloise Asylum at the time, how did they deal with that when someone would pass, especially when there wasn't a family to come and take that body back to the family plot?
Well, you know, the other thing with people that were in Eloise, whether it was, you know, so there was kids there too. There's kids, teens, adults, male, female. Back in those days, it was kind of, you were kind of like the black sheep of the family. You know, your family would take you there, mm-hmm. and that's where you would stay. You know, there wasn't, it's different now, a lot different now, because my son has Joubert syndrome. And he lives with us and he goes to school and everything like that. But I always think, and it makes me sad, because back in those days, you know, early 1900s through 1950 or 60, he might be at a place like that. The care for people has changed. But there's a lot of times where people would go unclaimed by their family. And they actually have, there's a cemetery there that has 7,100 bodies buried in it. And they use that cemetery until 1948. It's called the Potter's Field. They're unmarked graves. They're little rectangular cement indentions in the ground with just a burial number on it. No names, no date of birth, date of death, just numbers that would coincide with the file for that person. So you can look the number up and then find the file and find their history and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. That's sad in itself. And then after 1948, they donated the unclaimed bodies to Wayne State Medical School here in Detroit for medical research or whatnot.
It is incredibly sad, and it's one of those things where if you do any digging into a family tree, depending on what information you can find, what was actually documented on that family tree, it's shocking how not far back in our history it was, where family members would essentially be almost like excommunicated or disconnected from, if we want to throw Scientology terms into it, you know, where it's literally pretending the person doesn't exist. And it's shocking sometimes, because I've done that myself, of just looking back and trying to trace, okay, well, who is, you'll find some random person and you're like, well, who is that? Like, well, that person technically wasn't their sister, that was really their cousin because of this or that. And a lot of times it goes back to so-and-so had X disability, right. and they were just, and they never saw them again. They just went away and they went to some asylum, as it was at the time. And it was almost as just writing them off. And you, I don't know how to understand that or look at that, because it's like, these were people. How do you simply just say, well, shit happens. Looks like you're going to go there now. No one cares. and I understand there was, you know, different times and places, you know, life was much more labor intensive and things of that nature. And oftentimes people would look at having children as getting more help for around the farm, yes. or whatever it may be. And if this one's not working right, well, we might as well send them over. So I don't know if there was just a different value or a different emotional connection that people would have with what we would call our loved ones. I don't know if the term loved ones maybe wasn't quite used as loosely as we do now, but it is shocking.
Well, I talk to people that, you know, they're older now, they're in their 70s and 80s, some of them that had, you know, they talk about when the family would get together for Christmas, and they'd bring Uncle Jim from Eloise Asylum, and they'd see him maybe on the holiday.
Yeah.
And then they'd pick him up and take him right back.
That's
where he lived. Yeah. And it's just, as they're older, they didn't realize it when they were kids. They just thought that was the way of life. But as they got older, they see that was not, he wasn't properly cared for, you know, with any of your relatives. And it blows my mind to think that was the norm. That
I know.
It was really the norm back then.
I've never heard anyone who's a senior in that generation where that would have existed as a norm ever look back at that and go, well, that was the right thing to do. It was more so there was no other choices. This is all we had to do. This is all we could do. And this is what society was telling you to do. This is how it was handled. It's all about perspective when we talk about these places, and we're talking about the point in time where things were going on. Were there certainly bad people involved in some things in some of these places? Sure. Abuses existed forever. But there's a lot of things that we may look on today as possibly being abuse, but within the standards of what the care was, some of the practices and things were simply best practices of the day. So you have this facility, and it operates well into I believe the early 80s. Is that correct?
Around 1982, the last of the patients, there's 150 when it finally closed down, and they moved them to other facilities throughout Michigan. And then the building that's left, there's actually five buildings left. The majority of them are tore down. There's the old fire station built in 1896 is still standing. The bakery was in great shape. That was built in 1907. And two kids in 2016, unfortunately, set on fire, and it's in pretty bad shape. The power plant had its own power plant. It ran the whole complex. That's still standing. The commissary building is still standing, and that would be where the train would drop off goods, drop off coal to the power plant. They actually had a meat, I saw pictures of meat, like rows and rows of cows hanging on meat hooks. And that's where they would, the butcher shop was there. Mm-hmm. And then the main building that's still left, it's around 200,000 square feet. It was the D building. And that was admissions for the whole hospital. The post office was housed there. And that cared for around 409 patients at its peak. During the Great Depression, there was around 10,000 patients and 2,000 staff. And it was the largest psychiatric facility in the United States at its peak.
Mm-hmm. What was life like in the facility in the 70s, because the last real decade that it saw would have been the 70s and then early 80s, kind of winding things down. What right. was life like in that facility in the last 10 years of its existence?
I think we've read a lot of news articles and actually talked to a lot of staff that came through that we've met and talked to about Eloise in the 70s and 80s, and it was more a lot of drug problems. Back in those days. So there's a lot of people that would get dropped off there with drug issues. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the treatments, they would get dried out for 60 days or whatever, and they still would get electroshock therapy. Electroshock therapy was still going on there until 77 or 78, I believe, mm-hmm. Right before they closed. And every floor changed. There was a woman's, when it was fully operational, the women had their own cottage, the men had their own cottage. I'm talking cottage, I'm talking 250,000 square feet, mm-hmm. each one. This particular building, that's still standing. The woman would be on the senior woman would be on the first floor, geriatric woman. The senior man would be on the second floor. The males would be on the third floor. Females would be on the fourth floor. They kept them all separated. They had sunroom. I mean, it was like a park setting when they'd let them outside sometimes. And that's the other thing I want to get to. I was reading back in the early 1900s, 1930s, somewhere around there. They used to chain, they called them inmates. They wouldn't call them patients. They used to chain them together while they were outside. And then one of the new directors came in around 1940 and decided to take the shackles off. And it's a symbolic thing. He buried them in a huge pit. And he started pioneering. That's the doctor, Dr. Thomas Gruber, started pioneering the music therapy and more compassion for the patients, because they call them inmates. Mm-hmm. And I find that kind of strange today. They weren't called patients, they're called inmates. So they were treated sometimes like inmates, like mm-hmm. they're prisoners, and they were understaffed. I talked to one orderly. He was in charge of 120 patients, one orderly for 120 patients. So, and mm-hmm. and funding was a big problem. And that's really why. Really, most of these mental institutions across the United States closed down was their lack of funding.
And did that come down to the states viewing them as viable?
I think, that once the federal government cut, I think it was around Ronald Reagan when he was president, cut a lot of the funding to the states to help operate these mental institutions, and then the state just couldn't afford it. So they started slowly but surely cutting them. And I think in Michigan, there's only three state-run long-term psychiatric facilities that exist today, and they don't have a lot of patients. I think one of them is still by Eloise. It was part of Eloise. It was built in 77. They have around 400 patients. Mm-hmm. So it's not, but I've been to West Virginia. West Virginia still has some larger mental institutions that are in operation. But most states, because of funding, healthcare costs are expensive now. They're pretty much closed down. And then they tear them down, unfortunately, because some of these are architecturally beautiful.
Yeah.
There's been a few. There's one in Michigan up in Traverse City.
Yep.
It was a Traverse City State Hospital. They've repurposed it, and it's in condominiums, a restaurant. It's a beautiful place, and it was a Kirkbride building. Kirkbride was the architect. There's a few of those still left around the United States, but mostly they don't get repurposed. They get tore down. And,
yeah.
You know, if you see old pictures of asylums, they're huge, huge, ornate buildings, kind of beautiful in an eerie way.
A lot of them very gothic-like structure. Summer, I actually, the Traverse City State Hospital, I got a chance to see it right as they were beginning to repurpose it about 15 years ago. A restaurant went into the very bottom floor of one of the multiple buildings there. And that was the only thing that had been there. It had not been turned into condominiums or assisted living facilities, anything like that. So it was just, it was one of the most bizarre dinners I've ever had in my life. A friend of mine invited me and said, "You have to see this place. I know you like creepy stuff." And we went there, and still, many of the windows were still broken out of this building. They're still broken out of many of the buildings on the campus. But this one just had this one little corner part of the basement that had been repurposed into this restaurant. And it was one of the weirdest experiences I'd ever had, because we dined in what would have been someone's room, but it felt more like a gothic prison cell. There was on the wall a piece of metal and hinge where you would have had a chain attached to it, and it's just right there next to the salt and pepper shakers and the rose on the table. It was very bizarre. I got a chance to dine there last summer for the second time. This is 15 years after.
It's a lot different now.
It's a lot different, yes. It's the hinge has gone from the wall. They think they realize this might be a little unsettling to some. And it feels more like you're going into a Napa Valley wine cave than it does an asylum basement or cells. However, the campus itself in Traverse City, there are many, many buildings still standing. Some are slowly being repurposed. Some are just sitting there. And I wandered around there for a good hour with my camera. And on my Instagram, at Tony Bruschi, I post the pictures every now and then of ones that I kind of go through and check out. And it's a haunting facility. And it's just amazing to think that there were so many of these all over the country, very few still standing. And it's easy to understand the lure of them as a ghost hunter or someone who wants to find out about the paranormal, to see these structures. I mean, even if there was nothing going on in them paranormal, just the urban exploration of what these facilities were. And now they've just been sitting there rotting for so long is...
They're so huge.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of these are huge, huge, huge buildings. And to me, I love the paranormal and the ghost hunting stuff, but I also love the history.
Yeah.
And you just think of how many thousands of people came through there. And they're not all bad stories. You know, there's good stories that the people were helped. And there's bad stories. There's a lot of patient abuse. There was a lot of regulation back then like there is now, and patient privacy. It's changed so much in the last, 40, 50 years. It seems like that's a long time, but it's really a short amount of time to where we are today.
Yeah.
I have my doubts and concerns about the way mental health is treated today. I think there's no place for them to go. I think asylums were good for that, because there was some place for them to go, because a lot of times they're homeless now.
Yeah.
Or they're in jails, especially here in Detroit. I think Wayne County, I saw a stat somewhere that 60% of the prisoners in Wayne County Jail have a mental illness.
Sure.
But there's nowhere for them to go. You know what I mean?
It's one of those things you kind of look at and go, had these facilities been allowed to continue to evolve with what current care standards are and what treatment standards are, they could have been very effective, wonderful places for people to be and be out of danger as well.
Right.
Because if you look at a lot of statistical facts as well as areas that saw homeless populations just skyrocket, it was around the time that a lot of these facilities were shut down. And then you saw, I mean, obviously they had to go somewhere and their families were no longer there or did not care. And it just, you know, it led to that. And it's very sad that these individuals, rather than getting care, essentially our society to a certain extent at one point said, we don't want to pay for this anymore. So good luck. And
I read a lot of stories, a lot of news articles and a lot of first person accounts that when these places closed, if you were severe, obviously they'd put you in another institution if mm-hmm. they could, if they can find room, but they were basically on their own.
Yeah.
The
bar to get into those facilities went much higher. And then many people who mm-hmm. didn't reach that bar, but still had serious problems. And this goes on to this day. Good luck, you know, go find a job or something rather than they need care.
Reform. I'm not political in any way.
No.
But I think healthcare reform still has to keep evolving and changing.
Yeah.
We're so far behind than a lot of other countries, unfortunately, and we have the best medical care in the world, but we're so far behind as far as taking care of our people.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not a political statement. I don't believe it's just an observation on what statistically happened when these facilities shut down. Let's talk about when you look back on these facilities, it shuts down in the early 80s. There are still people obviously around today, many people around today that worked there, maybe had treatment there. That have a memory of these facilities operating. How far back are you aware of the first ghost story existing within this campus? I'm assuming it probably somewhat goes back to its operational days, people having stories. But as far as what you found, where does that first pop up of someone saying something paranormal might be going on somewhere on the Eloise Asylum campus?
I think, there's always this ghost stories you hear of even when people were there when it was fully operational, staff that worked there seeing, you know, but a lot of it was so taboo back in those days. It's not like it is now where it's mainstream. You and I can sit here and talk about it and it's okay. Mm-hmm. Back in those days in the 50s, 40s, 50s, 60s, even 70s, really too, there wasn't a lot of people to talk about. So they kept a lot of things to themselves. And then I think that's cool. What we do is, you know, people are elderly now and seniors and they'll come up and tell us some of their stories. But I think really, it really started to peak when it finally shut down around 81, 82. And they were basically abandoned, these huge, huge buildings abandoned on this huge campus. And that's when you can start getting the urban exploring. And then that's when you started hearing rumors of, you know, unexplained occurrences and ghost stories and, you know, footsteps and disembodied voices and things like that. It just carried over. And so Eloise grew kind of a legend here in Michigan. It's a very haunted place, and it's always been off limits. We were lucky enough to get in there in 2018. Do the first paranormal investigation there. But even staff that had worked there, the county, Wayne County, had senior service office there. And I talked to employees that worked there. I work for local government, so I know some of them. They were scared to go in some place in that building. They just had strange feelings. They'd hear doors closing when there was no one else in the building, lights shutting off and on. Sometimes they hear screaming. So it kind of grew, that legend grew and grew and grew to where it is today. And people sometimes, you know, get down on us a little bit, say, oh, you're making fun of mental health, and that's not really it at all. We don't bring up any we don't know who the patients are. We don't know what these voices mean. We don't know what these knocks mean, these doors closing mean. And that's kind of, people don't understand the paranormal, I guess. It's more of exploring what we like to do. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And it doesn't have to be an asylum or a prison or anything like that, because you can have paranormal activity in a 1,000-square-foot house.
Sure.
You know, it doesn't, but it just seems that there was so much energy. And my theory is we're all energies to begin with, and sometimes our energies linger. Why do they linger? I don't know. But that complex had so many people over its 100-plus years come through there, over 10,000 deaths on the property. I mean, some of that energy is going to be retained in that building, in that area. And I think that's some of the stuff that we get. Talking to us, energies that are still there.
When the Eloise Asylum closed in the early 80s, were any of the buildings repurposed into anything, or was it essentially doors locked, windows locked, let's hope nobody breaks in?
They tried to maintain it. They left, when it started to close down finally, left five county employees to try and maintain, keep up the grass cutting and do the painting. And so it was just too much of they just had the money. Budget-wise, they couldn't do it anymore. So they tore the majority of the buildings down. They used the one building, D building, for quite a few years after for like Focus Hope and senior services. And there's an adult daycare in the building that's still open today, or not tore down today. but no, they didn't repurpose any of those. And they could have. There was a huge, beautiful theater there. They used to have the patients do pageants and put on shows. Big shows a couple times a year, big Christmas celebrations there. And that's the good stuff that happened at a place like this that people don't realize. It wasn't, you know, people think of asylum. Asylum means taking refuge. It wasn't all torture and barbaric. There was things that happened that was, like we said earlier, it was the medical practice of the time. Mm-hmm. But if I always think if it could evolve to where we are now, these asylums could actually help people, but, yeah. They're not anymore, but no, they didn't. And this, the guy that bought this, he's a developer, bought this in 2018 and he's going to turn into a hotel, actually a 1930s, Art Deco type hotel. It's a huge building. Some of the staff stayed in this particular building and still standing. There's little apartments in the front of the building that nurses and orderlies had stayed in. And it's I'm glad they're keeping it because I'm huge into historical preservation. I hate seeing buildings get tore down for no reason. Just because they want the space or they want to put a new parking lot in or a new store when they can actually repurpose these. And these have been around for hundreds of years and they're still standing. They're built so good back in those days. But that's the hope. It's going to turn into a hotel, and we'll see what happens from there.
That wraps up part one of our conversation with Todd Vonner about the haunted Eloise Asylum. In part two of our conversation, we'll ask Todd, when the Eloise Asylum closed in the early 80s, what happened to the campus and its buildings? Are any of the 10,000 souls who perished in the Eloise Asylum buried on the property? What was Todd's first paranormal experience at the Eloise while exploring it illegally as a teenager? What was it like to return to the haunted Eloise Asylum for the first time as an adult? And who are the spirits that haunt the Eloise Asylum today? All that and more in part two of our interview with Todd Vonner of Detroit Paranormal. To hear it, become a Gravekeeper. That's a supporter of our program. Simply sign up at thegravetalks.com, click Become a Gravekeeper, or patreon.com/thegravetalks. $5 a month gets you access to every single interview that we've done in its entirety, part one and part two. Hundreds of them there just waiting for you to binge away on. Patreon.com/thegravetalks. Check it out and help keep our program on the air. You also get access to our programs months before they're released to the public in their entirety. Advanced episodes and extended episodes, all there for you. Patreon.com/thegravetalks. Until next time for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.
Will you?